Well, next hour, we're going to talk about creatures, but this hour, we'll continue chatting with Robert Zimmerman about all things space, and we'll take your calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Robert Zimmerman with us. We'll get to your calls. Robert, do you know what makes us old?
What?
In just a few days, you and I would have witnessed man walking on the moon almost a half a century ago. A half a century ago.
Unfortunately, yes, George, I have to say. That's unfortunate.
Yes. A long time ago.
Yeah, it is. It's a long time ago. And when I was growing up and when you were growing up, it was expected that, you know, 50 years hence, we would have colonies on the moon and colonies on Mars, and we'd be heading out to the asteroid belt. And it's unfortunately, it's taking longer than we dreamed. And I strongly have many opinions about why it's taken so long, and how I'm very, very hopeful for the future right now, because we're finally dumping the bad ways of doing things, and the new, what we're doing is going back to the American way of doing things, and that'll be exciting and fast and innovative and creative, and we'll accomplish a lot in a very short period of time.
Well, with the kind of technology we have today, I mean, when we talk about 46 years since we were on the moon, with we've got more firepower in our smartphones than they had in those lunar commanders and the landers.
When I wrote Genesis, the story of Apollo 8, you know, which is available as an ebook right now, about that first mission to the moon, I was astonished when I was starting to read the original transcripts of that mission. There'd be whole periods when the astronauts on board would be listening to ground control reading off a long string of numbers. I mean, we're talking about a long string of numbers, several minutes worth. And the astronauts would then repeat the numbers back. What they were doing was they were entering data from the big, big, big computers down on the ground that had done some really complicated calculations, and they were entering that data into the tiny computer on the Apollo 8 capsule. That computer on the capsule had about as much capability as a very cheap Casio $20 digital watch with a calculator on it. It had very limited capability. And I read those transcripts. They had to get every one of those numbers right, and they had to enter them all correctly, and it wasn't trivial, and they had to do this like multiple times during the entire mission. And so, yes, they did a remarkable thing when they did that. Think about how remarkable that was and how much easier it should be for us now to do it. And it's one of the reasons SpaceX, for example, is trying to do a vertical landing of a first-stage rocket. Well, people have gotten lazy, and for decades have said, well, it couldn't be done. Well, no, that company said, wait a minute, we have really smart computers. We've got 50 years of knowledge about how to control craft. We should be able to do this. And they are demonstrating that it's doable. They're demonstrating that it might not be easy to do, but if you really work at it, we have the capability now to do that kind of thing. And that's what I find really exciting.
Why do you think the Soviets, Russians never pursued sending a person to the moon after we went?
Well, obviously, they were there like we were. It was a race to the moon. And they were there to prove that they could do it better than us. And obviously, when it was a defeat, their government was pretty clear about this. We're not going to embarrass ourselves by continuing to do something that we know we've lost, this war, this competition. So we're done. We never, and Brezhnev was very clear about this. I wrote about this in a different book, Leaving Earth, about the post-Apollo era. Brezhnev was pretty blunt about the lie. What Brezhnev said at that moment was, we never intended to go to the moon. We were always building space stations. Well, that was an outright lie. They were trying very hard to get to the moon. And once they lost the race, there was no point pursuing that mission any longer. That's essentially what went on. And they decided, well, it's time we do something else instead so we don't look bad. And so that's what happened. That's why they abandoned it.
Who goes back to the moon, the Chinese or India?
It could be us. It could be anyone. What's going to happen? Look, for example, the Google X Prize, Lunar X Prize right now, is a competition for private companies to land a rover on the moon by, within 2 years. That'll be a private company doing that. Private people. It will be private money, no government money at all. So who's going to go first? I can't tell you. It's really interesting how things are going to unfold in the last decade, because we are coming out of what I called 5 years ago a very difficult transition in the United States from big government-run program that wasn't getting much done and costing a lot of money to private competition, many different companies competing. And that competition is really firing up the whole worldwide competition. I mean, it's not just in the United States. The fact that SpaceX and other American companies are coming up with cheaper ways to do things is forcing other countries and other, such as the Russians and the Europeans and the Indians and the Chinese, to be creative themselves, because they got to compete. And so what you're going to have is a space race. I like to call it the new colonial movement, because without question, every nation in the world that has this capability or thinks it should have this capability sees a, and this is not a pun intended, a vacuum out there. There's a lot of resources that they want to claim control of. And the only way they're going to do that is to get up into space. And this time there's no native peoples to interfere or be conflict with. You just have empty land. And so we're going to see a major push by the world over the next century to get into space, to claim it, to learn how to use it, and to gain knowledge from the resources that are there.
Okay, now we go to the phones. You've been waiting a while. We go east of the Rockies. Mike in Bristol, Connecticut. Welcome to Coast, Mike. Go ahead.
Good morning, George. Thanks for taking my call. I got a couple of simple questions here.
Sure.
First question is, why are all the planets round in our solar system?
Oh, that's an easy one. That's an easy one, Mike. Gravity. It's not just a good idea, it's the law. I mean, what you got here is, once you get enough mass accumulated in an object, it's going to take the most efficient shape. Because of the force of gravity. It's very difficult to have a mountain stand high on an object, to have an out-of-shape, non-spherical object when it gets very large. Gravity wants it to descend to the lowest, there's kinetic energy there, potential energy. Well, it wants to use that energy. Objects don't, it's like, rocks on top of a mountain, they're precarious, they're going to fall down. And so if you've got a oblong-shaped object, it's going to want to reshape itself into a spherical object. And that's all it is. It's basic gravity.
And what's your second one, Mike? Yeah. Go ahead, Michael.
How come the moon doesn't rotate?
Well, it does rotate. Its day is exactly the same length as its orbit around the Earth, because the Earth's gravity pulls at the moon and basically makes one side of the moon always face the Earth. But as it's going around the Earth in 14 days, it's rotating relative to the sun. So its day is 28 days long. Its night is 14 days long. Its day is 14 days long. But from our perspective on the Earth, only one side of the moon faces us at all times. And this is, once again, gravity. Gravity is the Earth's much stronger gravitational field is pulling on the moon so that its rotation eventually settles into a 28-day rotation that matches its orbit, so that one side always faces the Earth. This is not an unusual phenomenon. A lot of moons will do the same thing, because their central planet forces their one face to always face the central planet.
Let's go to our wild card line now. Earl is in Seneca Falls, New York. You're on with Robert Zimmerman. Earl, go ahead, sir.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, gentlemen. I have basically a far-out question for you. The Halley's Comet, it takes 86 years to
76.
Make a complete 76. Circuit of our solar system, 43 years in, 43 years out. I would like to know if this probe that's going by Pluto will continue on out past and hopefully discover what is the object that Halley's Comet gets shot around, so it would come back in to our solar system. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. And I thought it was 76 years.
It is 76 years, but that's okay. I mean, you know, this is, those are the details. But it takes 76 years to orbit the sun. There isn't an object out there that throws it back to the Earth, back into the sun, towards the sun. It's on an orbit, just like the Earth is. It's just a very eccentric orbit that is not circular like the Earth's or Jupiter or most of the planets. It's eccentric. It's very oblong. And so it comes in very close to the sun, and then it flies out somewhat out beyond Pluto and comes back in again. And it takes 76 years to do that. New Horizons is not going to be able to see anything having to do with Halley's Comet. We're talking about vast spaces out there. And New Horizons, in order to get to Pluto within a reasonable amount of time, 9 years, had to travel very, very fast. And so they're hoping after the flyby of Pluto that they're going to be able to fly it past other Kuiper Belt objects, other objects out in that region of the solar system very far away. But it's traveling fast, so they only have a very narrow cone. They can only maneuver sideways a limited amount. And they've looked with Hubble and with New Horizons for objects, and they have some candidates, but they have not determined yet if they're going to have anything they can look at after the fact. And they really were hoping to see a second Kuiper Belt object. But it's always a gamble, and it's possible they won't find anything. They're talking about a very vast amount of space. It's very empty out there. And even though there's a lot of Kuiper Belt objects, they think that in the thousands and thousands, it's not a lot of objects in a very, very vast amount of space.
Outside of planet Earth, what do you think is the most exciting object in our solar system? Europa, maybe?
It depends on what I've looked at that day, George. I mean, right now, Pluto. But a few weeks ago, when Rosetta was getting its first images back of Comet 67 PCG, well, that was the most exciting. But, you know, whenever Curiosity gets new images, that's the most exciting. I mean, it's all cool. Whenever we're seeing something new, it's really great. Cassini images from Saturn, I mean, gosh, Rudy. the images of Titan, the giant moon of Saturn, which is a planet essentially, it has lakes of methane, hydrocarbons. It probably has rain of that material. It has great storms. They've been able to watch two seasons, because it's a long year. It's 30 years long, something like. So each season is about 7 years, and Cassini's been there about 7 years. So they got to see parts of the summer and winter on one of the hemispheres, and they're beginning to see changes in the weather patterns on Titan in that very alien environment. That's cool. So you ask me what's cool. It depends on what new thing we've discovered on any daily basis.
Let's go to Bill, West Hartford, Connecticut. He is the amateur astronomer. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes. Hi, Robert Zimmerman. It's great to talk to you again. This is a fantastic, fabulous time to be alive. Those three unmanned missions, of course, Dawn, its orbiting series, and New Horizons flying by Pluto, and a few months back, and still now, Rosetta and Philae landing on the comet 67P and Rosetta orbiting it. I wanted to first point out one quick thing before I ask you two questions about Rosetta and Philae. If the Soviet Union's N1 rocket had not failed four times, crashed or exploded, if at least they had gotten into Earth orbit so that the rocket, which was even more powerful than the Saturn V, had worked, they would have had a leg up, not counting their command module, which is still the Soyuz up to this day, in their LK lunar cabin, which was their version of the lunar module, not counting those two spacecraft, at least the rocket would have worked, and they would have had a better chance of going to the moon, because they had tried to go to the moon, as you pointed out.
I have to add, though, that even one success would not have gotten them to the moon, and as a lander, they had never really even come close to really getting that technology worked out. They had designs, but they had not come close, and the resources to build it was just not there in the Soviet Union. It's a big government, corrupt, inefficient way to do things, and so they never really were close. Even if the N1 had succeeded once, that doesn't mean they've got a rocket they can rely on, especially with the other failures. I should note that the October failure of the Antares rocket sending a Cygnus capsule to ISS was another N1 Russian rocket failure, because the first stage engine that was being used by the Antares rocket was a refurbished engine from the N1 rocket in the Soviet era. The Russians had saved them and kept them in storage. They sold them to Orbital ATK, an American company, then refurbished them, and they were using them on the Antares rocket. Well, it failed. And there were some fundamental design flaws, I think, in that engine design, and that is so I don't think they would have gotten to the moon even if they had gotten one successful flight. What would have happened is they would have wasted a lot more money on a program that really wasn't going to work. So give me your questions, Bill. I always love your questions.
Let me get my question. On 67P, you mentioned two astrobiologists. I can't pronounce one's name. He's an Indian. You know what I'm trying to say? He and other scientists said that the Rosetta orbiter, or maybe it was the Philae lander, had potentially found microbes inside the comet 67P. So question number one is, could you discuss a little more about that? Question number two, also about Philae and 67P. Philae did come to life about a couple of weeks ago for a few hours. What are the chances of it coming back to life when sunlight again hits the solar panels of the lander? Philae come to life longer and give more photos and data from the surface of 67P?
Well, all right, the first question, I had already touched upon that in the first hour. The scientists had made a credible, reasonable case for some of the data suggesting the existence of microbiological life that was picked up by Philae. But it's not extraordinary data, and there's a great deal of skepticism in the scientific community about that. And that's really all there is to it. We're not going to be able to confirm or prove one way or the other until we get better data. Now, as to whether Philae will come back to life, it came back to life intermittently, short contacts. They think part of the problem is the orientation of its antenna and the position of Rosetta. But Rosetta, when the comet started to get really active, they no longer flew it into really close orbits because they tried it once and they discovered that its guide star system was getting confused with the dust particles, and they did not want to lose Rosetta. So they pulled back to a safe distance, and they've been doing research from a safe distance, and they can do that. To get a better communications with Philae, they've got to reorient its position. It's not really in orbit around the comet. It's really flying in tandem with it. But they've got to change its position to get better communications. And they've been in the process of doing that. And they've been trying to get, they're getting repeated communication contacts with Philae, but they're all short. And when they get a better position from Rosetta lined up with Philae better, they're hoping then they'll be able to get the data that's on board the lander and get more data from the lander and get the lander to do some more observations. In a sense, because it landed in shadow, they're going to get – it's actually a blessing because they had expected Philae to stop working once the comet moved closer to the sun because the heat would be too great and the lander wouldn't function anymore. But because it landed in a shadowed cliffside, it's actually going to be able to survive longer and therefore give us much better data later on should they get that data. And because they've gotten contact again, they're likely going to get that data. So I'm very hopeful. Just give it a few more weeks as they push to get this working again. But right now it looks very, very hopeful. And when they get that going, they're going to finally be able to get some pictures from Philae on the surface of a comet. And you ask me, George, what's the most exciting object? Well, for that day, that's going to be the most
exciting. That's going to be it.
It's going to be cool.
You got it. Robert Zimmerman's website, of course, BehindTheBlack.com, linked up at CoastToCoastAM.com, and several of his books, Genesis, The Story of Apollo 8. It's an ebook now, too, and The Universe in a Mirror, Leaving Earth, and the Chronological Encyclopedia of Discoveries in Space. We're going to come back with him in a moment and take some final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie back with you, along with Robert Zimmerman. Robert, what is new at BehindTheBlack.com?
I'm in the process of posting it right now. It'll be after we got off the phone. I was up at the Pluto website, and they've released another double image of the two planets, Charon and Pluto, and I'll get that up in a few hours. So that's the most interesting that's going on right now, George. as I say, what's the most interesting object? It's when the new news comes in, and it's very, very cool. They've done it in color too, which is even cooler.
What do you think it could be the most surprising thing about the Pluto mission?
Well, I hate to make a prediction. I have no idea. We'll see once we get there. I mean, that's the thing about it. You don't know until you get there. And since things have been so unique, I'm looking at this double planet image right now of both Pluto, which has this orange tinge to it, if it's not dark. Mm-hmm. And next to it is Charon, which looks gray, like the moon, but very dark gray. They look completely different in this image, but we're not seeing a close-up of Charon, so it's hard to tell right now. But it's gray. It doesn't have that color that Pluto has, and I don't know why. I suspect because it's dark, it's probably very similar to most asteroids, mostly dark, dusty, very primitive materials. Pluto, being larger, was able probably to gather, and its history, we don't know what its history is, was able to gather in other materials that gives it, an interesting color pattern.
You know, because of the primordial soup is the same in the universe, is it easy to assume that all these objects will have the same elements, the same complexity? They may all have carbon. They may have, gold.
Well, yes, except for one thing. Imagine you're cooking, you get two chefs and you want to cook soup. Well, they're pulling from the same they might even think of Iron Chef. They pull from the same ingredient possibilities in the refrigerator, but they come up with completely different recipes.
Right.
Well, we've got the universe is infinite, and the possibilities are quite, the laws of gravity and some of the basic physical laws are really not very complicated. But the possibilities that they, with the number of elements that exist, the possibilities are infinite. And so that's what we're seeing. We're seeing basically a different soup that was handed to us by nature and God at every place that we go. For example, we are made from stars. Supernovas produce
or stardust.
And they throw them out, and then the solar systems form from that. Depending on the supernovas in the region that this star formed, you're going to have a slightly different mix of basic elements. And so, yes, you'll have all the same. That's what astronomy has taught us with spectroscopy in the last 200 years, that, yes, the same elements exist everywhere, but the numbers and percentages can be different. And that affords us infinite variety and possibilities.
Let's go to John now, first-time caller, Sebring, Florida. Hey, John, go ahead.
Thanks so much, George. Wonderful program, and I have four questions for Mr. Zimmerman. Sir, Mr. Zimmerman, privileged to be on with you.
Thank you.
Your Genesis Apollo 8 is in eBooks. Where eBooks?
If you go to Behind the Black, there's a link right there to get it. Yeah, you can get it from my publisher itself as an ebook. You can also go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, do a search for Genesis, the Story of Apollo 8, my name, and you'll see the various editions that have been published. The print editions are basically out of print right now. You can get them, but they're used copies generally. However, the ebook is available. It's been updated. I have an afterword in. I have a forward there that I've brought in, and Valerie Anders, the wife of Bill Anders, one of the astronauts, wrote a forward as well, updating what has happened in the 17 years since I wrote the book, and the 40 some odd plus years since they flew the mission.
Now let's go outer space with four questions. I'll give you two at a time if that's okay with you. Images back to Earth, radio waves, how do they do it? And the spacecraft that are orbiting out there, how do they, their propulsion system, how does it keep going on and on?
Well, it depends on the craft. As I mentioned, Dawn uses an ion engine, which uses a different design. It's basically firing photons out, or some variation thereof. It's very, very low acceleration, but it's very, very efficient. You don't have to carry a lot of fuel, and it can work for long periods and really move you around much more with greater flexibility and last longer. But it's slow. It takes a long time to get from point A to B. That's an ion engine. Most of the spacecraft out there use chemical engines, which have a limited amount of fuel. It's one of the reasons, for example, Messenger, when it was orbiting Mercury, it can only stay there for, like, 3 years? But when its fuel and its thrusters ran out, they basically couldn't keep it in orbit anymore because it was an unstable orbit, and so they basically crashed it into the planet. With chemical engines, you basically have to use orbital mechanics too. Same thing's happening with New Horizon. They sling it past other planets to get it moving faster, such as Jupiter, and they have to time the launch to take advantage of how the planets move relative to each other, because chemical engines just don't have enough fuel to really maneuver as well as they'd like. So they get there faster, but you have a limited flexibility in how you do it.
Images back to Earth, radio waves, how is it done?
Well, I mean, if you're asking me about communications, that's just, you know, like we use telephones, radio waves, mm-hmm. and I'm not an engineer. I can't go into the specifics.
It's like smartphone technology,
yeah, exactly.
Basically.
If you're talking about, like, radio astronomy, what they're doing there is they're looking at radio emissions that come from objects in space, most of which are high-energy black holes, as a general rule. In fact, the field of radio astronomy was born with a radio telescope that wasn't designed originally as a telescope. It was doing research for radio work, and Jansky, the man who was doing that research, detecting this bursts coming from the center of our galaxy, and he realized that he was detecting emissions coming from the supermassive. He didn't know it at the time what it was, but coming from the center of our galaxy, it was the supermassive black hole Sagittarius A star that's there. I think that answers your question. I'm not sure.
Yes. What causes gravity? And Halley's Comet in 96, did I see Halley's Comet? I think
no.
I did.
No. Well, in the late 90s, you saw a comet, Hale-Bopp. It was a magnificent comet, much, much more spectacular than Halley's Comet because of just of the orientation of as it flew past the sun. It happened to be positioned well to really see it well from Earth. It was really spectacular, one of the best comets of the century. I lived in New York City at the time, and you could be in Midtown Manhattan with all their bright lights and look up and see Comet Hale-Bopp. It was pretty amazing. As for what causes gravity, you'll have to ask a philosopher about that or a religious person.
Or Isaac Newton, if you were around. Huh?
Say again?
Isaac Newton, if you were around.
Well, no, Newton would explain how gravity works and how it functions, but why is it there? That's a philosophical question.
Well, really?
I always make this distinction. Science tries to explain the how and the what, but philosophy and religion tries to explain the why. And they are very different things. They are not mutually exclusive. They can work together, but they are definitely working to answer different questions.
Do you think religion has something to do with gravity?
Religion attempts to explain gravity. A belief system such as any religion is trying to explain why the universe is here. Why is it shaped the way it is? What formed it? Why
are we here?
Is it formed the way it is? And different religions have different beliefs. Different philosophies have different beliefs. Some of them are not atheists. Some are religious. That's a different show, George.
Oh, yeah. And a great one, too, Robert.
Yes. I am a secular humanist, but I come from a Jewish tradition which is very open to scientific research and knowledge. It says that God can do what he, you know, can design a universe as he wishes, and it's our job as humans to explore it and learn how it functions.
But, you know, we both know, Robert, there's more to this than we even know.
Yes, Shakespeare said that. And Shakespeare
we know that. let's go to Anthony in Spokane, Washington now. Anthony, thank you for holding. Go ahead.
I have two questions. Question right. One is, can Robert say something about Sedna? And question two would be, why can't the New Horizons be crashed into Pluto or Charon if it's not probably going to go anywhere beyond that?
All right, well, first, Sedna is one of the other Kuiper Belt objects. It's a very large object. It's a planet in its own right. I don't remember what its size is off the top of my head relative to Pluto. I don't want to take a guess. You know, a Google search will answer that question very quickly. But it's a large object out there. It's not trivial. If we could get close to it, it would probably be spherical and a planet. But it's very far out there. But it's a Kuiper Belt object. Pluto is in the Kuiper Belt. It's an object, a belt of distant objects, all from the very early period of the solar system. Now, as for crashing into Pluto, no. You got to remember, this is a flyby mission. They've thrown a rock very fast, and it's going to zip past this planet, and it can't. It's going so fast, it can't turn around or stick around. It's going past. It's kind of like you're standing by the freeway and a car goes by. Well, that car can't stop on a dime and turn around. It's going to go by too quick. And that's essentially what's going on here. When it passes Pluto, it's still moving out into the Kuiper Belt, and they're hoping that in the cone of potential area that they can reach while it's still functioning, they're going to be able to maneuver it past other Kuiper Belt objects. That has not yet been the next, if there's a potential object they can reach, they have not announced that yet.
They say it's 1,600 kilometers, which would make it about 1,000 miles.
Yeah.
In diameter.
You know, once again, answering the question of whether that's probably smaller than Pluto, but I can't remember what Pluto's size is, you know.
Yeah.
But it's not trivial. It would put it in the range of something like it would be called a dwarf planet by some scientists today, but it's almost certainly going to be spherical.
All right, next up we go to Carter in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan in Canada. Hey, Carter, thank you.
Hi, yes, thank you. I just have an interesting question here for both of you. Do you believe, I've seen this theory in movies and TV shows about an alternate universe, like at the edge of the universe, you'll wind up in an alternative reality. Do you believe that it exists, or there's any evidence, or there's any theories on that?
I'll answer that pretty straightforward. You used a very key word in your question, do you believe, which is getting once again into faith, and we're moving out of science and into a belief system there. There are scientists, physicists, theorists, who have come up with ideas of multiple universes, trying to figure out the very complex physics of the subatomic world. But I will tell you mildly, those are theories. And I've been at press conferences where they've been proposing these theories, and I really do feel like I'm at a science fiction world con sometimes when I'm there, because there's no evidence. It's theoretical, based upon very skimpy facts in the subatomic and also in the cosmological research field. Our facts there in both those fields are on the edge of the known and are somewhat limited. So there are gigantic uncertainties. And so you can come up with many interesting theories, such as multiple universes and multiple dimensions and so forth. But because of the uncertainty, someone else can come up with an equally justifiable theory that is completely different, which means we don't have enough data to really know what the truth is.
Okay.
So there it becomes belief at that point, and faith and philosophy.
Thank you.
Okay, Carter, thank you. Appreciate you being part of the program.
I hope that answered the question.
You know, Robert, you can tell you have an incredible enthusiasm for all things space. I mean,
I'm interested in exploration, George, pushing the unknown. Space is the most obvious aspect of that, but I did mention earlier that engineering research, building a better rocket, would do that. But similarly, you know, I'm a science journalist. I'm interested in any scientific research that tries to learn something new. Medical research, it's the same thing. Anything humans do that is going to push back the black, behind the black, the unknown sky, that what's behind it, to me, gets me excited. And it doesn't have to be space. Space is the most obvious representation of that, but it's not the only example of it.
Let's go to Kansas. Eric's with us now. Eric, you are on with Robert Zimmerman.
Oh, okay. Hey, our electromagnetic what can I say, expressions, our electromagnetic frequencies, our interference, our human electronics, microwaves, radio waves, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, all that. How far out into space
does that go?
If you could measure it, does that go?
Robert, it's endless, isn't
it? It's actually a good question. One of the things that has revolutionized the field of astronomy in the space age era is the ability to put space telescopes above the atmosphere to look out into the universe in more than just optical wavelengths, because the optical part of the electromagnetic spectrum is tiny. And phenomena out there, stars and black holes and galaxies and planetary nebula and stellar binaries and, you know, giant blue giants, all kinds of stars, they emit energy across the entire electromagnetic spectrum. And to try to understand how they function and what's going on there, you've got to study the whole electromagnetic spectrum. And so we've been able to put up telescopes now that look across many different wavelengths of energy coming in. I mean, I mentioned Sagittarius A star, the supermassive black hole in the center of our galaxy. We didn't know it existed until Jansky invented radio astronomy, and we got the radio signals from it. But we also get X-rays and infrared images from it. We can't see the optical at the center of the galaxy because the dust in between blocks our view. But we can see in all these other wavelengths, and it allows us to actually track the stars that circle that black hole. There are stars that orbit it. And recently there was a star, they thought it was a gas cloud, but it wasn't. It was a star that recently plunged very close to it and came back out again. And they're tracking these things, and they do it because we now look across the whole electromagnetic spectrum. It comes down from outside the solar system into our solar system from the interstellar space, all these energies from all over the universe, and they provide us knowledge and information. You get cosmic rays in space. It's one of the actual problems. Some of this radiation is actually an obstacle to human exploration of the solar system. We're going to have to learn how to protect ourselves when we travel beyond our magnetic field, which protects us. And we will. We'll have to figure it out, though. It's one of those challenges that I think humans love to solve.
You make space interesting, Robert. Thanks for being on the program. Enjoy your weekend, okay?
Oh, thank you, George. Thanks for having me. I really enjoy it. And thank you to all your readers as well, your listeners as well.
BehindTheBlack.com, great website. Spend some time looking at it. You'll learn a lot about space. I'm coming back in a moment. It's Creature Time on Coast to Coast AM.